Welcome to Hour One of the Arizona Republic for January 6th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, I'll be reading National, Valley and State, and USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, Maduro and Wife Plead Not Guilty in Court, written by Tao Nguyen, Christopher Kahn, Bart Jansen, and Chris Kenning. Deposed Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro pleaded not guilty in federal court on January 5th on U.S. drug trafficking charges, days after he and his wife were captured by U.S. forces in a surprise attack on the oil-rich country. Maduro, dressed in prison garb, entered his plea shortly after noon Eastern Time. His wife, Celia Flores, also pleaded not guilty, Reuters reported. I am innocent. I am not guilty. I am a decent man. I am still president of my country, Maduro said through an interpreter before being cut off by U.S. District Judge Alvin Hellerstein. Hellerstein ordered Maduro held until a March 17th hearing. Maduro, his wrists bound by zip-tie restraints, was ferried by helicopter from Brooklyn, where he was jailed, to Manhattan early January 5th. Protesters both opposing and celebrating Maduro's capture rallied in the cold outside the courthouse, separated by police. Maduro and Flores are charged in a four-count indictment linking them to a 25-year narco-terrorism conspiracy. Speaking to reporters on Air Force One, President Donald Trump described the case against Maduro as infallible. Maduro has long denied involvement in drug trafficking. The attack marked a significant escalation against the South American country after months of rising tensions, threats, and oil tanker seizures. The operation has drawn support from Trump's allies, but also bipartisan criticism, as lawmakers have questioned the legality of an operation to seize the head of state of a foreign power. After Maduro's capture, the governance of the South American country remains unclear, with Trump saying the U.S. is in charge of Venezuela, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio saying the focus remains on using leverage to force the oil-rich country to act in line with American interests. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations defended the military action in Venezuela, calling Maduro an illegitimate leader and rejecting claims the move could destabilize the region. Michael Waltz, who spoke at an emergency Security Council meeting, described the mission as a surgical law enforcement operation and said it will not result in a prolonged occupation. While speaking with reporters late on January 4th, Trump said his administration is dealing with the people that just got sworn in an apparent reference to Venezuela's Vice President Delcy Rodriguez, who has been named as acting president. Trump told reporters he had not spoken to Rodriguez yet, but others have, adding that he will speak to her at the right time. He later said the United States did not give anything to Rodriguez in exchange for cooperating, but noted she is cooperating. Rodriguez previously rejected Trump's claims that she was willing to work with his administration, but adopted a softer tone in a statement late on January 4th. She called for a balanced and respectful relationship with the United States, adding that relations between the two countries should be based on sovereign equality and non-interference. We invite the U.S. government to collaborate with us on an agenda of cooperation oriented towards shared development within the framework of international law to strengthen lasting community coexistence, Rodriguez said in a statement on Telegram. Earlier that day, Trump had issued a warning against Rodriguez. If she doesn't do what's right, she's going to pay a very big price, probably bigger than Maduro, Trump told The Atlantic. When asked if he would demand free and fair elections in Venezuela, Trump said, "It depends." Before elections can take place in the country, he said Venezuela needs to be fixed. We're looking more at getting it fixed, getting it ready first, because it's a mess. The country is a mess, he said. Trump also called on Rodriguez to provide the United States with total access to Venezuela's resources. He noted that oil companies wanted to enter Venezuela and repair oil infrastructure. Venezuela is recognized as having the world's largest proven crude oil reserves, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Trump has said U.S. oil companies could start investing again in the region, a practice halted when Maduro's predecessor, the late Hugo Chavez, expropriated the assets of foreign oil companies. The Cuban government said January 4th that 32 of its citizens were killed during the U.S. raid to capture Maduro. Those killed were all members of Cuba's armed forces and intelligence agencies, according to Havana. The country is holding 2 days of mourning for those killed. Trump acknowledged to reporters January 4th an unspecified number of Cuban deaths and said the island country will no longer enjoy the financial support of Venezuela. Following Maduro's arraignment, his defense lawyers could raise complex legal issues before reaching what Trump acknowledged could be a slog of a trial. Maduro's lawyers are expected to challenge the court's jurisdiction over his case by arguing the military attack on Venezuela violated international law, according to Jimmy Gurale, a former prosecutor who is now a law professor at the University of Notre Dame. The lawyers could also argue that he deserved immunity as a head of state, Gurale said. The defense is also expected to make a broad request for evidence in the case, which could include classified information that the U.S. government could refuse to disclose. The next article is titled, "Arizonans Express Mixed Views on Venezuela Attack," written by Daniel Gonzalez and David Ulloa. More than 120 protesters in Arizona peacefully demonstrated January 3rd against the U.S. military strikes in Venezuela that resulted in the capture and arrest of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The protesters came from many different backgrounds, but the Arizona Republic found few Venezuelans in the march against the military intervention. At the same time, many other Venezuelan exiles in the state praised the military action in hopes it would lead to a better future for the country of their birth. Maduro's capture brought a mix of exhilaration and uncertainty for some, and a mix of anger and uncertainty for others. "We welcome this," said Alejandro Martinez, a Mesa resident who left Venezuela as a child. "We are trading in one form of oppression for a different form of oppression," said Isabella Herman, who also left Venezuela as a child. Mesa resident Alejandro Martinez was visiting his Venezuelan family in Florida when he heard his mother screaming. It was 2 a.m. and Martinez had been asleep. He was terrified. He thought someone was breaking into his family's house in Pompano Beach. Fear soon turned to elation when Martinez came out of his room and discovered why his mother was screaming. The United States had attacked Venezuela, and as Martinez found out later, had captured Maduro, the Venezuelan president. Many Venezuelan exiles, such as Martinez and his family, despise Maduro as an authoritarian dictator responsible for the country's terrible conditions that have forced nearly 8 million Venezuelans to flee. Most settled in Colombia and other countries in Latin America, but hundreds of thousands have come to the United States. I think myself, and I would say almost all the Venezuelans I know, we're happy about this. I will not lie, to be fully honest, we welcome this, the 30-year-old marketing strategist said during a phone interview on January 3rd, shortly before he planned to fly back to Arizona after his family visit to Florida. Martinez said he immediately began scrolling news and social media sites on his phone to find out what was happening in Venezuela. He said for him, the sight of U.S. military helicopters flying over targets in Venezuela brought a sense of justice, although he worried about casualties. A cousin in Caracas sent him photos of a room filled with broken glass after a missile strike on a communications center nearby blew out the windows in the cousin's apartment. The context in Venezuela is very complicated, Martinez said. Like many Venezuelans, Martinez believes Maduro stole the 2024 presidential election in Venezuela. Maduro has been in power since 2013, upon the death of President Hugo Chavez. The Maduro regime lost those elections, and they refused to accept the results, the democratic results, Martinez said. What I can tell you is this has been going on over 20 years of pillaging, plundering, stealing of resources, arresting citizens, innocent civilians. People from political parties that are not aligned with Maduro have been arrested and tortured. And there's been years of poverty caused directly by this government. We've seen our country destroyed. So for us, this is kind of like a moment of justice being served to people who really deserve it. Martinez said his father is an international businessman, and his family came to the United States when he was 7 to flee the Chavez socialist government. Later on Saturday, Martinez said he and his family went to a Venezuelan restaurant in Pompano Beach to be around other Venezuelans. He described the mood as a mixture of joy, hope, and uncertainty. He heard some of the Venezuelans at the restaurant talking about returning to their home country, either to help rebuild the country or visit relatives they have not seen in years. Martinez said he would like to see his grandparents again, who are really old. I'd like to see my cousins, my uncles. This is why we were hoping that we can go back. We're hoping this will lead to a change for the better, Martinez said. I'm personally hoping that I can be reunited with my family. I haven't been to my country in over 10 years because of the government there. Isabella Herman was one of the few Venezuelans at the protest. She wore a baseball cap with a small embroidered Venezuela flag on the side. Herman said she was a child when her parents left Venezuela to escape Maduro's regime. She agrees with many Venezuelans that Maduro and Hugo Chavez, Venezuela's former president, were bad people. She considers herself in the minority of Venezuelans against U.S. intervention. Herman joined the protest to show not all Venezuelans who live abroad support the annexation of our sovereignty by an imperialist country who only wants our oil and our resources, she said. We are trading in one form of oppression for a different form of oppression, Herman said as she marched along Van Buren Street. U.S. intervention in Latin America has never resulted in prosperity for the people. It has always resulted in pillaging of our resources and exploitation of our people. Venezuela is just the next victim. Protesters said the U.S. military intervention violated Venezuela's free will in choosing its leaders and was a ploy to rob the country of its oil for the profit of major corporations such as ExxonMobil. Many of the protesters agreed that the socialist president was a dictator, but they did not believe the United States had the right to bomb the country and apprehend Maduro. Honestly, it's such an interesting feeling to experience another start of another useless war for profit, said Lexiri Coronando, 23 years old, an activist with the Party for Socialism and Liberation. The impromptu protest was organized by the Party for Socialism and Liberation and spread through social media. The protesters ranged in age from their early 20s to a woman in her walker who was in her late 90s. The protesters began their 2.5-mile march from the Vietnam Veterans Memorial on the Arizona Capitol grounds. They marched east on Van Buren Street, then eventually looped back to the state capitol. Most of Washington Street, the road that leads to the capitol, was filled by the protesters as they chanted phrases such as, "We got Venezuela's back! No more plane and boat attacks!" Activist Jordan Napier said the protest was not about whether or not you agree with Maduro and his government. The question is, do you agree with the brazen war drive that they're doing? It's blatant imperialism, and they're not trying to hide it, Napier said. The next article is entitled, Pentagon Acts to Censure and Demote Kelly Over Video, written by Ronald Hansen. The Pentagon has moved to censure, demote, and reduce the pension of Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona over his involvement in a video urging troops to refuse illegal orders in a matter it described as reckless and seditious in nature. As a retired Navy captain who is still receiving a military pension, Captain Kelly knows he is still accountable to military justice, Secretary of War Pete Hegseth said in a statement posted on social media on January 5th. The Department of War and the American people expect justice. It does not mention the court-martial President Donald Trump and Hegseth initially threatened, though it did say that further violations could result in further action. In a statement, Kelly, a Democrat, cited his lengthy service as a Navy combat pilot and NASA astronaut. "I risked my life for this country and to defend our Constitution," he said. If Pete Hegseth, the most unqualified Secretary of Defense in our country's history, thinks he can intimidate me with a censure or threats to demote me or prosecute me, he still doesn't get it. I will fight this with everything I've got, not for myself, but to send a message back to Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump, don't get to decide what Americans in this country get to say about their government. The standoff between Kelly and the Pentagon comes 2 days after Kelly was among the many Democratic lawmakers critical of the United States toppling Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in Caracas. Kelly, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, has 30 days to formally respond. The Pentagon statement did not spell out his reduced rank or how much money Kelly stands to lose from the rebuke. Kelly has formed a legal defense fund in anticipation of fallout from the Pentagon over the November 18th video he made with five other congressional Democrats. Hegseth said the discipline stemmed from Kelly's public statements from June through December 2025, in which he characterized lawful military operations as illegal and counseled members of the armed forces to refuse lawful orders. Kelly pointed to his 39 combat missions in the Gulf War and four missions to space, including one after his wife, former Representative Gabrielle Giffords, Democrat of Arizona, was the target of an attempted assassination 15 years ago that killed six and wounded 12 others near Tucson. "My rank and retirement are things that I earned through my service and sacrifice for this country. I got shot at. I missed holidays and birthdays. I commanded a space shuttle mission while my wife Gabby recovered from a gunshot wound to the head, all while proudly wearing the American flag on my shoulder," he said. "Generations of service members have made these same patriotic sacrifices for this country, earning the respect, appreciation, and rank they deserve. Pete Hegseth wants to send the message to every single retired service member that if they say something he or Donald Trump doesn't like, they will come after them the same way. It's outrageous and it's wrong." In a December 15th letter to the Navy, Kelly's lawyers did sketch out their legal view that Kelly broke no rules and would consider all his options, which presumably includes filing a lawsuit over the matter. Separately, the FBI is reviewing the video with an eye toward all six Democrats, though career employees in the Bureau reportedly cited a lack of legal and factual basis for bringing a case against them. They include Senator Alyssa Slotkin, Democrat of Michigan, Representatives Jason Crow, Democrat Colorado, Chris DeLuzio, Democrat Pennsylvania, Maggie Goodlander, Democrat New Hampshire, and Chrissy Houlihan, Democrat of Pennsylvania. Kelly was investigated by the Pentagon because he was the only veteran who could still be subject to provisions of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Both the Pentagon and Justice Department reviews grew out of Trump's ire over a video that stated the military's policy. Congressional Democrats have called the reviews an instrument of retribution and called to drop the probes while asking for documents relating to the administration's deliberation over the matter. Some Republicans have similarly made clear they didn't see the need for Kelly to face punishment from the Pentagon. Senator Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi, who chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee, shook his head when CNN asked December 11th whether it's appropriate for Kelly to be punished by the military. Asked to explain, Wicker replied, "You asked me that question, and my answer is no." On November 25th, Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, said Kelly valiantly served our country in the Navy and as a NASA space shuttle astronaut. She called the accusations against him reckless and flat-out wrong. "The Department of Defense and FBI surely have more important priorities than this frivolous investigation," she said. Throughout, Kelly has struck a defiant tone, vowing he will not be intimidated by an administration seeking to silence him and others who take issue with Trump's agenda. Kelly has repeatedly said the video grew out of his concerns that Trump has for years called for illegal actions, such as his desire for the military to kill the families of terrorists and to have them shoot the legs of protesters in America. "We know you are under enormous pressure right now," the video message said. It did not specify what exactly the military might view as illegal orders. "Our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders," Kelly said in the video. Trump reacted angrily in social media posts, urging the Democrats to be tried for sedition and unsubtly echoing the punishment, "seditious behavior punishable by death," Trump wrote on November 20th. He toned down his comments in an interview with Fox News the next day. "I'm not threatening death, but I think they're in serious trouble," Trump said. Hegseth struck a similar tone in remarks on November 25th. "The despicable video urging troops to refuse illegal orders may seem harmless to civilians, but it carries a different weight inside the military," he wrote. "This was a politically motivated influence operation." He dubbed the group the Seditious Six and said their message erodes cohesion. Hegseth may have undermined his own outrage when CNN published on December 3rd a 2016 video of Hegseth in which he sounded more like the Democrats he has criticized. "I do think there have to be consequences for abject war crimes," he said in the 2016 video. "If you're doing something that is just completely unlawful and ruthless, then there is a consequence for that. That's why the military said it won't follow unlawful orders from their commander-in-chief. There's a standard. There's an ethos. There's a belief that we are above what so many things that our enemies or others would do." Kelly told CNN that Hegseth's 2016 words were exactly what we said. "I think it begs the question, what has changed? It's pretty obvious what has changed. We have an unqualified Secretary of Defense who only cares about sucking up to this president." The Democrats' message took on new relevance after the Washington Post brought new attention to the first of the Pentagon's military strikes that have killed at least 115 people. The administration has said all those targeted were drug couriers. The first operation, however, involved a controversial double tap in which two people who survived the first strike were killed in a second attack after they allegedly tried to climb aboard the floating and fiery wreckage of their boat. The Post reported that Hegseth had issued an order to kill everyone as part of two strikes on a boat in the Caribbean that the U.S. government has cast as drug couriers. The New York Times largely refuted Hegseth's direct involvement in the second strike on the second target in that September 2nd incident. The Times said Admiral Frank Bradley, commander of the operation, ordered the second strike under the authority of Hegseth's original guidance. Top Republicans and Democrats in the House and Senate's Intelligence and Armed Services Committees received a briefing on the incident and saw a complete video of the strikes, with reactions falling along party lines. Kelly and his colleagues, who made the video, have said they were unaware of the particulars surrounding that missile strike when they made their message. You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled "Rubio Takes Charge of Venezuela's Future," written by Francesca Chambers and Michael Collins. The capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife was a personal victory for a key member of the Trump's administration, Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Rubio, the son of Cuban immigrants, has for years been advocating for the removal of Maduro and his predecessor, President Hugo Chavez, arguing the former is not the legitimate president of the Caribbean nation of more than 28 million people. Now, his close ties to the Cuban and Venezuelan diasporas in the United States have landed him a direct role in shaping Venezuela's future. President Donald Trump said the United States would run Venezuela until there can be a safe, proper, and judicious transition. He signaled Rubio and the Department of War Pete Hegseth would be in charge, alongside Venezuelan Vice President Delcy Rodriguez, who was sworn in as interim president on January 4th. Rubio is under immense pressure to deliver on his vision for a free and prosperous Western Hemisphere. For the native Miami son, the transition is both a personal and existential one that those who know him say he is uniquely positioned to manage. Rubio identifies with the plight of the Venezuelan people, said Jason Marzak, Vice President and Senior Director at the Atlantic Council's Adrian Asht Latin America Center. This is really Marco Rubio's moment to shine, he said. What we saw occur in the early morning hours in Venezuela would not have happened if Marco Rubio was not at the top tiers of the Trump administration. Brett Bruen, who served as White House Director of Global Engagement during the Obama administration, agreed, saying there is no doubt that the U.S. operation that removed Maduro from office was Rubio's creation. Jose Malaya, who has known Rubio for 30 years, said all of the former Florida senator's experiences have led him to this moment. It's almost, he said, like the guy was born for this role. After all, Rubio grew up in a community mourning its inability to return to its homeland, and he cut his political teeth thanks to powerful Cuban exiles who became top players in the GOP at the height of the Cold War during the Reagan era. Rubio inherited a worldview ensconced in hawkish stances when it came to Cuba and Venezuela, or any country that dared to embrace a socialist agenda in Latin America. Maduro received his early political training in Cuba and, as president, formed a critical alliance with Havana. In his 2012 memoir, American Son, Rubio wrote that at 21, volunteering for the first congressional campaign of State Senator Lincoln Diaz Balart, I spent the entire summer learning Miami politics from the ground up. Miami politics from the ground up is code for the playbook written by Jorge Mas Canosa, a CIA-trained exile who founded the Cuban American National Federation, one of the most effective lobbying groups in Washington. Whatever the outcome is of Cuba, Venezuela, the region, it's personal to him because he's from this community of exiles and of people who have suffered greatly, Malaya said. Rubio has long believed that if Maduro fell, the communist regime in Cuba could topple as well. In the Senate, he was a frequent, outspoken critic of the Maduro government, and sponsored legislation to provide millions of dollars in humanitarian assistance to Venezuelan migrants and to force a transition to a democratic form of government. He fought Presidents Barack Obama and Joe Biden over their push to normalize relations with Cuba and Venezuela, even as, at the time, swaths of Cuban and Venezuelan Americans supported a détente. Eventually, Rubio's journey led to his current role as Secretary of State. He was able to gain Trump's trust and then use his influence to help persuade Trump to abandon efforts to negotiate with Maduro, leading to the military raid on the presidential compound in Caracas and Maduro's capture in the early morning hours of January 3rd. "The Rubio way turned out to be the winning solution," said Carlos Trujillo, a former member of the Florida House of Representatives who has known Rubio for more than 20 years and served as an ambassador in the first Trump administration. "Still," Trujillo said, "Trump's decision to use military force to remove Maduro from office was a leap of faith." "It could have gone terribly wrong," he said. "You're putting a significant amount of American service members' lives at risk. So the fact that the president has that much faith and confidence in Rubio's assessment and his judgment and his ability to deliver great information to make informed decisions on, it really speaks to the value that he has within the administration and really the value that the president places in him." Trump's personal longer-term commitment to Venezuela is unclear. The administration has been careful not to reveal details about how it envisions Venezuela's future. "That," Marzak said, "means that there are a number of questions that continue to mount insofar as how to actually ensure that this operation accomplishes Rubio's goal of bringing in a democratically elected government that respects the livelihoods and the freedom of the Venezuelan people." Elections were held in Venezuela in 2024, with Edmundo González seen by some as a legitimate winner after Maria Corina Machado, the opposition leader, was barred from running. Maduro declared himself the winner. For much of the past year, Machado called on the United States and her longtime friend and ally Rubio to rescue the country. Rubio supported Machado's nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize, which she was awarded in 2025. But instead of Machado or González, Rubio's counterpart will be former Vice President Rodriguez and the remaining members of Maduro's inner circle, according to Trump. Asked January 4th on Face the Nation how he envisions working with Rodriguez, Rubio said it was too early to tell. Complicating matters for Rubio is that, in addition to Secretary of State, Trump has given him multiple other roles in the administration, including National Security Advisor. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article titled, "Leaders Urge Trump to End Threats," written by Kim Helmgard and Antonio Finns. Greenland's leader declared enough is enough, and Denmark's prime minister urged the White House to stop the threats about taking over Greenland after President Donald Trump reiterated his wish to do so. And Trump suggested Venezuela won't be the only Latin American country to face upheaval as he addressed reporters January 4th on Air Force One while flying back to Washington from Florida, where he spent the holidays. Denmark Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said January 4th, "It makes absolutely no sense to talk about the United States needing to take over Greenland. The U.S. has no right to annex any of the three countries in the Danish kingdom." With ousted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in U.S. custody, Trump also continues eyeing Cuba and Colombia, and he previously has spoken about the Panama Canal. When the President of the United States says, "We need Greenland," and links us to Venezuela and military intervention, it's not just wrong, it's disrespectful, Greenland Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen said. A day after the U.S. military captured Maduro and removed him from the seat of power in Caracas, Trump spoke with reporters at Mar-a-Lago, saying the communist Cuban regime on a Caribbean island 90 miles from the U.S. shores remains in his sights. He spoke more January 4th on the flight. "Cuba looks like it's ready to fall," Trump said. "I don't know if they're going to hold out, but Cuba has no income. They got all of their income from Venezuela, from the Venezuelan oil. They're not getting any of it, and Cuba is literally ready to fall." The president also reiterated aggressive comments toward Colombian President Gustavo Petro, who last month denigrated the Trump administration as a clan of pedophiles, citing investigatory files from sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. As for Colombia, led by the leftist Petro, Trump said the country is run by a sick man who likes making cocaine and selling it to the United States. Asked January 4th whether the United States will conduct an operation in Colombia, Trump said, "Sounds good to me." Petro, in response to Trump's threat, issued a lengthy statement on X. "If you arrest the president whom a good part of my people want and respect, you will unleash the popular jaguar." The Trump administration's specific plans for Venezuela were unclear. Trump said Washington will run the country, while Secretary of State Marco Rubio suggested coercion would persuade Venezuela to act in the United States' interests. On December 21st, Trump appointed Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry as special envoy to Greenland. Landry has publicly expressed support for incorporating Greenland into the United States. Greenland's strategic location between Europe and North America makes it a critical site for the U.S. ballistic missile defense system. The island's significant mineral resources also align with Washington's ambition to reduce dependence on Chinese exports, Reuters reported. The move has elevated concerns again in Copenhagen that the same could happen with Greenland, which is a Danish territory with limited self-rule. "We do need Greenland, absolutely. We need it for defense," Trump said in a magazine interview. Threats, pressure, and talks of annexation have no place between friends, Greenland Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen said on Facebook on January 4th. "Enough is enough. No more fantasies about annexation." Speaking January 4th to reporters on Air Force One, Trump said he would revisit the topic of Greenland in 20 days. It wasn't immediately clear why he chose this time frame. The White House didn't immediately respond to a request to explain the timing. Denmark, like the United States, is a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which means that both NATO countries are covered by the alliance's security guarantee. Denmark also has a separate defense agreement with the United States that allows the Pentagon access to Greenland. Trump has repeatedly suggested that the United States needs to annex Greenland because of its strategic location and mineral wealth. His remarks have confounded Danish and Greenlandic officials. After the raid in Venezuela, some European officials and legal and foreign affairs experts have expressed concerns about the legality of the U.S. operation and seizure and what signal it sends to authoritarian leaders around the world. Military force is justified only in response to a clear, credible, and imminent threat to the security of the United States or its treaty allies. The Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, a Washington think tank, said in a statement. Venezuela, whatever its internal dysfunctions or connections to the international drug trade, does not pose such a threat. Using forces absent that standard is not defense, it's aggression. It substitutes coercion for diplomacy and power for principle. Rubio has said the nation is not at war with Venezuela itself, only against drug trafficking organizations. As part of his Venezuela announcement on January 3rd, Trump said an oil embargo on it was in full force. Once one of the most prosperous nations in Latin America, Venezuela's economy nosedived further under Maduro, sending about 1 in 5 Venezuelans abroad in one of the world's largest exoduses, Reuters reported. The administration is in position to fully shut off its oil shipments to Cuba. The petroleum subsidies the Maduro regime has supplied Havana with were one of the few remaining sources of foreign aid the Cuban government has been able to count on. Currently held by Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel, the communist regime in Havana has remained in power for 67 years. The next article is entitled, Venezuela's New Leader Has Deep Leftist Roots, written by Laura Villagran. Venezuela's interim president, Delcy Eloína Rodríguez Gómez, has a long political memory that stretches back to her Marxist father, who died in detention during an earlier government before a leftist movement rose in its wake. Now, President Donald Trump is watching her every move. The 56-year-old newly sworn-in interim president assumed Venezuela's most powerful office after U.S. forces captured President Nicolas Maduro on January 3rd. Rodriguez, who served as vice president, continues to insist Maduro remains Venezuela's legitimate leader. She denounced the U.S. strike as a brutal attack, called Maduro's ouster a kidnapping, and at one point demanded the United States show proof of life following the strike. Amid her firebrand talk, Trump issued a direct warning to Rodriguez. If she doesn't do what's right, she is going to pay a very big price, probably bigger than Maduro, Trump told The Atlantic the day after Maduro's capture. But Secretary of State Marco Rubio suggested Venezuela's new leadership would work with the Trump administration. We expect to see more compliance and cooperation than we were previously receiving, Rubio told NBC's Meet the Press on January 4th. With Nicolas Maduro, you could not make a deal or an arrangement. While Rodriguez has deep roots in the country's hardcore leftist politics, she's also seen by the Trump administration as someone willing to negotiate with the United States and its interests in the region, which distinguishes her from Maduro. Also, unlike Maduro, Rodriguez doesn't face U.S. drug trafficking charges. She has appeared on the Treasury Department's list of sanctioned individuals for at least a decade, according to the Congressional Research Service. Once head of Maduro's communications ministry, later foreign minister, and then vice president, Rodriguez is listed as ranking among Venezuelan officials suspected to be involved in anti-democratic actions or policies, serious human rights abuses, and public corruption. Venezuela transitioned to democracy after a decade-long military dictatorship was ended in 1958. But the country's leftists found themselves marginalized in the new democratic elections that were dominated by two larger political parties. Rodriguez's father, Jorge Rodriguez, served as Secretary General of the Socialist League and participated in a leftist guerrilla movement that never got off the ground. In the mid-1970s, her father was detained in the kidnapping of American businessman William Niehaus. He died while in custody of the government of elected President Carlos Andres Perez, according to a CIA missive. Rodriguez was a university law professor when the military officer and revolutionary Hugo Chavez first attempted to overthrow Perez in his second term. Chavez was later elected, and other guerrillas behind the kidnapping of Niehaus eventually became ministers in the government. Rodriguez and her brother, also named Jorge Rodriguez, closely aligned themselves with the socialist politics that became known as Chavismo. The next article is entitled, Downtown in Queen Creek Takes Shape, written by Maritza Dominguez. From farmland to a booming town, Queen Creek is setting out to build a downtown core from a blank slate. It's a very different approach to that of many older established cities around Metro Phoenix. Queen Creek incorporated less than 40 years ago and has since grown to a town of more than 84,000 residents. It's one of Arizona's fastest growing communities. It's attractive because of its family-centric feel and new home builds. It serves as a bedroom community to more built-out neighboring cities closer to Phoenix. The town began its downtown development about 10 years ago. It started with the recruitment for a local brewery to help launch the area. Queen Creek was an untapped region at the time, Jennifer Lindley, the town's downtown development manager, said. It started with an ad with Craft Brewers Guild, an Arizona-based organization. That attracted Old Ellsworth Brewing Company, a family-owned microbrewery. Queen Creek purchased land along Ellsworth and Ocotillo Roads with the purpose of developing a project that would anchor its downtown. That way, the town would have more control over what type of development it wanted to attract. In May, a $120 million project called the Switchyard broke ground on about 8 acres the town sold to developers. It's poised to kickstart Queen Creek's downtown presence. It will add popular restaurants and multifamily housing. Queen Creek wants more office buildings in its town and within the downtown area. Lindley said it wants to attract smaller-sized office buildings that will fit medical offices and small businesses, as well as companies that have hybrid work schedules. She said that the town's office vacancy rate is 0%. The hope is that the town will keep jobs in Queen Creek. Most residents commute into the broader Metro Phoenix area. The next article is entitled, CDC Changes Advice on Vaccines, written by Ahmed Aboulanein and Michael Ehrman. The United States ended on January 5th its long-standing guidance that all children receive vaccines against flu and three other diseases, a sweeping change that advances one of the Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s long-term goals. Public health experts warn the latest rollback could lead to preventable hospitalizations and deaths. The action, which removes the recommendation for rotavirus, influenza, meningococcal disease, and hepatitis A, also states that parents should consult healthcare providers under what it calls shared clinical decision-making, was approved by Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Acting Director Jim O'Neill, without the agency's usual outside expert review. It advances Kennedy's campaign to pare back childhood vaccinations. In December, President Donald Trump urged the United States to align with other developed nations by reducing the number of shots for children. Trump said the new schedule was rooted in the gold standard of science and aligns the United States with other developed nations. In a post on his Truth Social platform, the president congratulated Kennedy and other health officials on the change. Many Americans, especially the MAHA moms, have been praying that these common sense reforms for many years. Thank you for your attention to this matter, he wrote, referring to Kennedy's Make America Healthy Again movement. Kennedy, a prominent vaccine critic, has previously led efforts to drop universal recommendations for COVID-19 and hepatitis B shots for children, citing links to autism that scientists have repeatedly debunked. Vaccine experts decried the changes they said put American children at risk. Dr. Michael Osterholm, director of the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, said there should have been public discussion on the risks and benefits of the potential impact of dropping the recommendations. Dr. Sean O'Leary, chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics, said other developed countries face different disease risks and have different healthcare systems than the United States. Unlike the United States, which depends on private healthcare, most countries provide basic universal healthcare that is paid for by the government. Any decision about the U.S. childhood vaccination schedule should be grounded in evidence, transparency, and established scientific process, not comparisons that overlook critical differences between countries or health systems, he said. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.